This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Powered by U-Mobile, Malaysia's number one 5G network.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C, and this is The Breakfast Grill. Now, joining me in the studio today is Dr. Darren Lim, international relations expert and senior lecturer at the Australian National University, as we have a conversation with him on Australia's foreign policy and how that foreign policy is shaped by global forces, its regional neighbours, and its local pressures. Darren, welcome to KL.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've joined us in a very much stormy weather, perhaps also similar and reminiscent to also our world geopolitical environment as well.
Indeed. Driving through what looked like flooded roads was quite formidable, and that well describes the international environment.
Well, let's just talk a bit about Australia's foreign policy, because many Malaysians, you know Australia very fondly. Many of us study and work there before, and we call it the lucky country. But I wonder, how does Australia's geography inform its politics or foreign affairs?
Look, it's been a long historical challenge. You know, we are located in Asia, but have our roots, or at least our modern roots, for the past couple of hundred years in Europe and with the United Kingdom. And so the country has really sought to manage the tension of that those political origins with its geographic location and cultural connection to the region. And this government in particular, under Foreign Minister Penny Wong, a person who's, I'm sure, very familiar to your listeners and to the country, has really sought to frame Australia's identity, both in its Indigenous heritage that goes back tens of thousands of years, its Westminster political institutions, and the kind of the structure of governance in our country that we value very highly, but then even equally as importantly, our connection to the region, and that we seek our security and our prosperity and find our identity both from our multicultural heritage and those connections that, you know, to the region, like our foreign ministers. So in terms of our foreign policy, I think, you know, if you think of the big picture grand strategy that Australia has sought to balance these different forces and these different heritages, you have our relationship with the United States, which has long been our security, major security partner. You have a second pillar of looking to engage with the region heavily. That has waxed and waned over the history, but I think for the past few decades, we've really leaned into the region. But thirdly, as a middle power, again, I'm sure that can be sympathised or empathised in this country, the promotion of a rules-based order, because our influence is maximised within a system of rules rather than one in which power is the only currency of foreign policy. So that kind of sort of, I think, locates us. We're in an odd situation given our colonial heritage and our geographic location. And it's an ongoing project to merge those two in ways that, balance our identity and our interests and our geopolitical environment in one package.
Yeah, so this grand strategy to, you know, create this project of merging all these different parts, I wonder whether or not this project and grand project really resonates with local, you know, Australians, right? Does the foreign policy integrate well with domestic policy?
Look, I think Australians, like most publics around the world, don't spend that much time thinking about foreign policy. And when they do, and there is an annual survey run by the Lowy Institute, you do see a thoughtfulness about Australia's place in the world, an understanding that, for example, trade is very important to us, that we have this multicultural heritage. I mean, so many Australians are either first-generation immigrants or second-generation. In my case, my father was born in Singapore. His tutu Chinese. His parents came from mainland China in the 1930s. And he came to Australia in the 1960s to study engineering, as was quite common in those days, and met my mother, who's from rural Victoria, and stayed. And so I'm, you know, in many ways, a first, second-generation Australian. And so there are so many of us, whether individually or with friends in our community, with those connections, that we understand the importance, even as we are also understanding of our sort of Westminster heritage, our alliance with the United States. So I do think there is broad support within the public for the pillars of this grand strategy. And you see really striking continuity in the foreign policy approaches of governments since the end of the Second World War.
But one can argue that actually Australia's foreign policy is very pragmatic. It's very much driven by trade, very transactional. And it felt quite evident perhaps in the relationship it has with China, because both really depend on each other economically, right? So as you say, waxed and waned, but under this new foreign minister, Penny Wong, the relationship has improved tremendously, right, between Australia and China.
Yes. Look, the relationship with China was quite stable from the 1980s, really coinciding with the reform and opening up under Deng Xiaoping through to the middle of the last decade. And you saw President Xi Jinping visit in 2014, inaugurate a comprehensive strategic partnership and a free trade agreement. And I think that bilateral relationship was very much underpinned by the strong economic ties, the value that both sides get from the relationship. But it wasn't only that. You know, there are lineages that go back to the recognition by Prime Minister Gough Whitlam in the 1970s of the PRC. And, you know, yes, there have been some bumps along the way, but by and large, I think both countries understood each other, understood the mutual benefit, and that was very positive. Now, in the second half of the decade through to, you know, just a few years ago, the relationship did begin to go down because we are different countries. We have conflicting interests. And at times, I think there were, you know, better and worse elements into the way that was managed on both sides. But under this government, there is a sense that there was a need to stabilise the relationship, that we do have common interests and they needed to be emphasised. And that required respectful, tactful diplomacy, as well as sort of, you know, policy moves that kind of aligned our priorities. And you've seen an uptick in trade really returning in most industries to where it was before. In December, our barley exports, an industry where we was exporting zero just a few years ago due to some anti-dumping tariffs, went to 90% of our total exports back to China in that month. And that was really reaching a high that had been reached before, but it's still quite remarkable. So it has rebounded quite healthily. It's not fully there in every industry, but the trend is quite positive. And I think most Australians are supportive of that.
Yeah, I think you're seeing this relaxation of all these export-import bans. I think we saw wine, I think, relax last year. Of course, the one looking forward to is lobsters. I think that's the big plan. The question, of course, then is Chinese Premier Li Qiang is also going to visit in June.
Yes.
You're having that seventh foreign strategic dialogue last month. What really will be the next ways of how China and Australia can improve and unlock more value between both countries then?
Look, I think both sides have economic interests that they would like to pursue. You know, there is always further opportunities to access the Chinese market from our side. On the Chinese side, they're very interested in our minerals industry. They're interested in foreign investment. And so I think the bilateral relationship is, you know, many of the outstanding issues have been resolved up to this point. But there's always room for growth. But then there are other new opportunities, for example, cooperation on climate change and in green technology, right? Both sides have interest in developing that. It's a global imperative to decarbonize. And so I think that area is one where there is potential for new initiatives. I haven't seen a lot said about it yet, but I think on both sides there are interests to do so. And then, look, if we want to be most optimistic, China is a very active player in the region, as are we. I would like to think that we can work together to partner and work with third countries. Look, that is something that is not straightforward. As our foreign minister said, Australia will always be Australia, China will always be China. And so we have different systems and different values. But we do share many overlapping interests, even though we have others that conflict. And that's the skill of diplomacy, to try to work for, find those areas where we have common ground and can work together. And where our differences are, you know, they are going to remain so, and you'd manage those as best you can.
I wonder how China, you know, views you from a geopolitical standpoint. Because, you know, Australia being a member of Quad and AUKUS, both are very US-centric alliances, right? How does China then look at Australia warily? Because you talk about, you know, Australia being a potential strategic partner in China beyond economic terms, but these two alliances make it very difficult, isn't it?
Yes, and beyond the Quad and AUKUS, you just have our bilateral alliance. And so, you know, if I'm sitting in Beijing, I'm seeing an alliance partner with the United States, much like Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. And I think that is going to colour every interaction. Like, there's no sense, I would imagine, that they expect that relationship to the alliance partnership to wane at all. There might be have been intentions to try to force some separation in previous decades, but I think at this point, it is well understood that that security partnership is very is central to our foreign policy. Mm. When I talk about cooperation, I maybe wouldn't label it security or strategic cooperation in the region, but more in the kind of the economic development space, right? That we have both have interests in supporting the region in its development aspirations. We go about things differently, but perhaps there are, you know, synergies or commonalities that we can find together. So, like, I don't, you know, I expect that Beijing views Australia quite cautiously, as we do them, and understands that there are limits to how far that cooperative relationship can go, but that there are sufficiently strong mutual interests that, you know, argue for a working, stabilised relationship, which is what we have right now.
I wonder how Australians view the Albanese government in its natural pivot away from the US to China, because you're seeing that a bit, right? In the past, you know, many accused Australia of being some puppet of the US mm-hmm. in the Pacific. That's clearly not the case, not on the fact that actually you allow Chinese technology, mm-hmm. actually you don't ban TikTok, Chinese EVs are selling also in Australia. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, you know, how do people think about that slow pivot towards China then?
Look, I could tell you how I think about it, which is more of a return to a longer-term equilibrium. Under the previous government, there was a real emphasis on national security and a real emphasis on sovereignty, I think heightened by the pandemic and also perhaps overshadowed with the shadow of Donald Trump and his presidency and trying to navigate the pitfalls, of, shall we say, of his leadership. And so Australia was much more forward-leaning, and that was seen as being in the interest by the government at the time. So I wouldn't frame the current move as sort of a turn towards China, but a return to a more balanced equilibrium. This government has reiterated that it has no intention of walking back any of the cooperation with the United States. In fact, new initiatives have been pursued. AUKUS continues to progress. We have a new climate change agreement, a compact, where it's possible in the future that US taxpayer funds could be used to invest in green projects under the Defense Production Act in the United States. So, you know, but never, there is still room for cooperation and working with other partners like China. So I think the Australian public, you know, polling suggests that they are supportive of this foreign policy, that they agree with the balance. And look, the best barometer of this is you don't see a lot of criticism from the conservative opposition that they're getting too close to China. At the margins, yes, on the day-to-day, but there is really a strong bipartisan consensus around a band in which foreign policy can act. This government is at one end of that band. The other government was a bit further out on the other side, but it's still quite narrow, and that reflects a consensus, I think.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and return with Dr. Darren Lim as we have a wide-ranging policy discussion on Australia's foreign policy. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile, Malaysia's number one 5G network.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. Sharing his insights on Australian foreign policy is Dr. Darren Lim from Australian National University. Now, let's talk about ASEAN, because actually, really, the relationship has also improved quite a bit. Just about a month ago, Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, played host to the second ASEAN-Australia Summit, right, on its 50th anniversary of its dialogue partnership. One won't doubt the strategic importance, but does it compromise its liberal democratic values when it works very closely with some of its neighbours in ASEAN?
I don't believe so. Look, we understand that our interests and so much of our identity is rooted in the region, that we can find ways to cooperate together and to look to understand each other better without needing to make domestic policy choices that, you know, compromise our values. And we would not expect any of our partners to do anything else either. So, no, that's never been a concern that there is a specific risk. Look, you know, foreign policy has to be pragmatic. You know, you're not going to agree and share identical values, and if you only talk to and work with the people who look and sound and work like you, you're going to have a very small foreign policy, and that's not going to be in the national interest. And I think that's well understood across the country.
Mm. So how does Australia view ASEAN, right? Does it address it collectively, or does it look at it on a bilateral basis with each member then?
I think both, but I think the big picture, Australia understands that ASEAN is an essential institution for the maintenance of regional order, that the ASEAN countries working together, coming to a common position, and I think wrangling the differences between them and coming out with that common position is essential for sort of managing great power rivalry, right? You know, ASEAN has no interest in either the United States or China, you know, exercising dominating influence, and it therefore is essential strategic ballast. And Australia wants to support that, that model of order, which is, you know, there's an equivalent story to be told here in the South Pacific with the Pacific Islands Forum, that the ultimately it's the countries of the region themselves who have to organise and work together to find an equilibrium that can work for them. And Australia sees the need to support that, working with ASEAN, keeping ASEAN central, even as it pursues bilateral relationships of importance, for example, with Indonesia, with whom we have many, you know, issues and interests that we need to work through. So I think that the country is managing to do both at the same time.
I wonder really, especially, I mean, you talk about ASEAN and so many leaders have changed or will be changing in the coming two years, right? We have one, I think, with Prime President of Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto. I think the question is really, we've had a good relationship between Australia and Indonesia, I think, under President Jokowi. Do you expect that healthy relationship to continue, or do you think tensions will increase?
No, I expect it to continue. Look, I'm not an expert in the Prabowo Subianto and his policy positions, but from what I understand, you know, he's looking for mostly continuity in the policy positions of Jokowi. There's a real lineage from Jokowi into him, and in terms of, you know, his son, Jokowi's son, being his vice president. And so I think there's going to be a lot of continuity on the foreign policy domain, and I expect that the leadership in Canberra is very eager to work with him as they work with his successor, his predecessor, I'm sorry.
Yes, but the question really here is that, is the conversations all very focused on economic terms, right? Because really, when you saw even what came out from the ASEAN summit, a lot of it was just about investment, you know, getting, I think, venture capital in place, a little bit about maritime security, but very much so the connective tissue between ASEAN and Australia is all about the economic potential between both powerhouses, really.
And I think that's correct. The Australian government under Labor has really emphasised the need to up our economic engagement with the region. And there was a special report and a special sort of individual appointed to lead that charge. But this also reflects the interests of the ASEAN countries. They are not looking to change the strategic status quo. They would like Australia's support, but no forward-leaning measures really seem to be in their interests. And I think Australia is supportive of that. So, you know, in our, what we're seeing as a need to develop economic interests, but also multiply those ties, personal, you know, business, political, as much as possible to locate ourselves in the region so that we can be a participant in the decision making when challenges arise. Hopefully they do not, but you want to have those relationships built in as strong as possible, shared understanding, trust, so that when things get choppy, when it's raining a lot outside, as it is this morning, you can navigate those together in a trusted partnership. So I think that's, you know, what you describe as the outcomes from that summit really reflect the interests of both sides at the moment.
Hence why I'm quite keen when you said just now that actually Australia wants to play that complementary supporting role of ASEAN, being that important ballast between, you know, the tensions between the US and China. How do you see exactly Australia's role there in supporting ASEAN there? Because ASEAN is also quite a loose coalition, isn't it?
Look, That's a very complex question, because when I think about how we engage with the region, a lot of our engagement is not just in trade, but in technical cooperation. So there, for example, something I'm working on right now is international technology standards. We have a risk with the concepts of de-risking and the Great Firewall on the other side of developing these separate systems of the internet and digital cyberspace. And in Australia, we have a lot of experience in managing our domestic digital networks, and that kind of state capacity, right? It's how to run a country effectively is something I think that is in high demand across the region, like developing those structures to manage the internet, to make decisions about which providers to use and how to build that infrastructure so that is secure but open. And so our support is in really in building the individual capacities of governments to manage some of the complexities of 21st century. You know, in terms of on a foreign policy sense, I think it really is listening to ASEAN's position and looking to support it, right? Not looking to go out the bounds of the, you know, so what they are comfortable with, and simply just offering our support. So I don't think there's anything concrete in that I can identify. It's that functional cooperation at the micro level and strategically at the macro level, just sort of understanding, you know, what they are looking for and what they aspire to keep the peace and to keep a strategic balance in the region.
Let's turn our attention to Palestine, because that really is, I think, one of the biggest geopolitical tensions happening all around the world. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong floated the idea idea of recognizing Palestine ahead of a two-state solution to help, you know, drive that path towards peace. How significant is this step, in your opinion?
Look, it is such a difficult issue. The domestic politics and the strong relationships that Israel has with the United States in particular, you know, are really one of the core dynamics of understanding why we are in the situation we are in right now. But the position, I think, of our government is, how can we maximise the security of both countries? And clearly, Palestine's security right now is in tatters, right, given the really aggressive actions by Israel. But a lasting peace does not occur unless Israel can find security as well. And this is a logic that applies across the world, right? China and the US will never be secure until the other is also feels secure. And so I think what we're seeing from Minister Wong is some creative and somewhat forward-leaning ideas that say to both sides, this is how you can both achieve security. It's a difficult thing, I'm sure, for the current Israeli government to listen to. But you know, in my personal assessment, their actions are not contributing to their own security right now. They're actually undermining Israel's security. And so they need to hear some of these difficult truths in order to, I think, begin to catalyze the processes inside Israel that can actually lead to change. So the significance, I think, it's bold because it is really putting forward a policy proposal that is the prerogative of Israel and Palestine. It is a step beyond where the United States has currently reached. But if you follow the trajectory of the Biden administration, it is inching slowly towards a similar view.
But the biggest challenge now is, in view of the recent attacks by Iran onto Israel, we're seeing this issue blow up into a bigger regional issue, and to the point where Israel has urged Australia to take a tougher stance on Israel, right? Basically asking them to designate Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organisation. Do you think the Australian government will do so?
This is not an area of expertise with me. I don't know is the answer to that question. I would like to think that the current, these recent attacks by Iran will actually be stabilising because they were a response to the quite unprecedented attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. That was quite a surprising move from Israel, given sort of the diplomatic protections that are normally apply to embassies. And so I think the strategists in the world understand that Iran had to mount a response. In my assessment, that response is quite measured and may be enough to sort of allow both sides to move on. And that would be a positive because it would stop escalation. But it is a very dangerous time and things could easily get out of control.
It is dangerous, and I think it's also quite a polarising issue, right? Even in Australia. I think in what you said just now about Sino-US relations, there's a bit more convergence between both sides. But in Australia, you even have the opposition leader Peter Dutton saying that concerns of Palestine could be Hamas sympathising. I mean, that's one end of the spectrum, isn't it, in how they think about the issue?
Of course. You're going to get different voices in the Australian debate. We're a democracy and it's healthy that all of these positions are aired, and there are those with much more sort of pro-Israel positions inside the Australian system. But this government has taken a very, I think, moderate stance, but also one you can track its movement over time, much like you can with the Biden administration, towards a position that looks like a Palestinian statehood. And I think the reason for that trajectory, both in the US and in Australia and across the Western world, who may have started much closer to Israel than much of the global south, is a reflection of how this conflict is unfolding. And that is, you can infer, I think, some pretty easy conclusions from that.
Darren, thank you so much. That was Dr. Darren Lim from Australian National University helping us unpack how Australia's foreign policy is evolving. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
Business Fueling Minds, the breakfast grill with U-Mobile Biz, Malaysia's number one 5G network. 5G makes business sense.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.